Ever tried reading while jogging, cooking, or even juggling flaming torches? Yeah, it doesn't end well. But with audiobooks.com, you can conquer books without the circus act. Dive into over 450,000 titles, including more than 10,000 free ones. Get hooked on a bestseller, find your next obsession, or finally read that classic you've been avoiding since high school. And here's the inside scoop. Sign up today for a free 30-day trial and snag your first three audiobooks on the house. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.
They were the heroes from the future. Teenagers protecting the universe from those that would sow the seeds of chaos. Each had unique powers and abilities, and though they often had their differences, they came together to save the day as the Legion of Superheroes. Now, you can be a part of their adventures and learn the history of the future in the Legion Clubhouse.
Oh boy, we've got another troubling issue this week, Matthew. I guess they're all somewhat troubling, but we're going to get into it as Chameleon Boy has a secret identity.
Action Comics number 383, Chameleon Boy's Secret Identity, published December 1969, written by Jim Shooter with art by Wynn Mortimer and Jack Abel. Synopsis, is Chameleon Boy secretly a jewel thief?
Poor Legion of Superheroes, exiled to the back pages of Action Comics.
And not even good issues of Action Comics, I mean.
Not even good stories of the Legion of Superheroes.
Well, I wouldn't go that far, but Action 383 is the story where two costumes are having a fight to see which one gets to date Superman. And
but we're not reading that. We're here for the Legion of Superheroes. In fact, that Superman story is really dumb. And the worst part about it is it carries over into the next issue. That's how bad it is. It is a two-parter.
It's a two-parter.
Yeah. So here's the deal. Chameleon Boy, still pining for his lost love in another dimension.
Another dimension.
Is invited to go to a Richie Rich party. Mm-hmm. You know, with all the hobnobs and the snobnobs. And, And Chameleon Boy sees a pretty girl. And he's like, ooh, I'm in love with the pretty girl.
But she's a spitting image for my interplanetary girlfriend, Elwinda.
That's right.
But she's from Canada. You don't know her.
She died on her way back. That's she's not right. Very smart, though, because she pulls out a crystal gem that suddenly blinds everyone. And Chameleon Boy has to transform into an umbrella to block the sun, to knock the gem from doing its thing. Right. And then the girl that seemed like she was maybe interested in him suddenly starts acting really weird around him.
Well, on the one hand, Elwinda, fake Elwinda, Janice, is in fact saying some terrible things about him. But in her defense, he did turn into a bird to spy on her to hear those things. So it's kind of a moment where you're like, yeah, she's a douche, but also he should not have heard those things. And he wouldn't have if he, you know, kept his nose to himself. But yeah, Janice is like, oh, he's orange and bald and pointy.
And he's
totally
really weird.
Turned off.
Yeah, I'm totally don't want to be him. And
she's
so,
like, I want a handsome Earth type face with dark eyes and black hair and a cleft chin.
And again,
I want
this
Cary Grant.
I think we have had this discussion before when it comes to a girl having to change her appearance to meet the needs of a boy. Here we're seeing the exact same thing happening here. And this is I call it the Grease conundrum, right? Where in order to get somebody to like you, you have to change your entire appearance and your entire personality and everything that you believe in and stand for yourself just to get, in this case, a girl to like you. And that is exactly what Chameleon Boy does. He becomes this Greg Brady looking dude.
Now, keep in mind, this is 1969.
I know.
Greg Brady's show just appeared in 1969, but he's 11, and he won't look like this Johnny Bravo kind of guy until about 1973. So this is actually the Legion looking back from the future to a time before It was after.
He just looks like a Greg Brady looking dude, and then they have a groovy time dancing in the pool with some squids on their faces. And she's not like freaked out by that, but she's freaked out by a chameleon boy who can change his shape and do all sorts of other things.
But it's okay, because he can change his shape, which means that due to illness, the part of Chameleon Boy will be played by TV's Michael Gray from Shazam. I'm telling you, it's a flawless plan. He puts on a little Lord Fauntleroy suit, and he's like, "Hey, baby, how do you feel about some false pretenses in our relationship?"
I know. Oh, I mean, that just sends a wrong message. But then again, if you look at a lot of the comedies that came out between... let's say 62 through the early 80s, a lot of it was, oh, gee, Bobby doesn't like me, or, oh, Judy doesn't like me, so I'm going to have to change my appearance or pretend that I'm someone else so that this person thinks that I'm awesome. And it's not, they're not doing some clever Cyrano de Bergerac thing. This is literally a person who's like, I am going to change everything about me so this vapid, you know, porn star wannabe is going to like me. And it's just, it's not a good message to send. Also, the Warren Estates, her last name is Warren. Do you think that's any nod to Warren Publishing?
Well, I don't know. But Warren Publishing started publishing like the mid-50s, and by 1969, I mean, we would have had Creepy, we would have had Eerie, we would have had, gosh, I want to say we'd be right on the cusp of Vampirella.
That's what I was wondering.
In 69, because Vampirella was late 69, like August, September of 69.
Mm-hmm. And this came out in December, so these would have been all around the same time.
It's entirely possible. Then again, it may be purely coincidental.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the thing about your Warren is your big-time Warren expansion and the real remembering and knowing, hey, this is Warren Publishing, da-da-da, came in about 73.
Mm-hmm.
So if it is, it's an early one. I would say it may just be a common name amongst raccoons.
It might be. It might be. I got to ask you another question.
Mm-hmm.
She's Wilhelmina, or whatever her name is.
Janice.
Uh-huh. Is she xenophobic? Is she racist?
Well, I mean, it's tough. You get into that point where she is clearly... saying, I do not like Chameleon Boy. I do not like him, Sam I Am. But also...
Look at everyone else that's at the party. There's nothing but white people at this party.
Well, yeah, but it's a Legion comic in 1969.
Oh, that's right. All the black people said, we're done with you people, and they left the planet.
All the black people are off on the planet Brigadoon. We'll get to that in just a couple of years, faithful spoilerite, so stand by for that mess.
Yeah.
I would say that it's a combination of two things. One, the fact that DC editorial circa 1969 will not allow you to show people who are not either traditionally Caucasian or blue, green, pink, orange aliens.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that this story doesn't really think too hard about it. It's just basically meant to be, you know, kind of an allegory for feeling left out and trying to teach you that you don't have to change who you are to be loved. But she doesn't actively say that the orange people are bad and terrible and they should be sent away and, you know, put in boxes or anything. You know, mm-hmm. She doesn't want to crack him on the head with a doorknob.
But boy, she's ready to throw her arms around Chameleon Boy in his passing for white outfit.
I think that is probably something that modern perspective is adding to the story that was
probably
absolutely not included or intended when Shooter wrote it.
Probably again, not, you know. Probably not intended, but, and again, we talked about this when we did the Mordrew issue,
right.
and Shadowlass had to cover up so right. that people wouldn't know that she was of a different color. It kind of, to me, feels like the same thing.
Well, this is 1969, and Shooter would be an 18 or 19-year-old kid, which means, in theory, he could have read Black Like Me, which came out in 61 by this point. And, you know, it could be not necessarily an intentional allegory for race relations, but it could be written to be that, hey, I'm secretly not what I seem to be. And, you know, it's complicating my romance thing. I think that probably the bigger question is going to be when you get to the end of this issue, and we never see Janice again, so spoilers. But when we get to the end of this issue, do you feel like Janet is a jerk, or do you feel like maybe she learned her lesson appreciate people?
I really don't think she learned her lesson, because here's what happens. This jewel that caused all the problems at the beginning of this 8-page story or 10-page story or whatever it is gets stolen, and the science police come down and they lock down the compound. And then Chameleon Boy goes undercover as a worm. And he's like, hey, there was something weird about that robot guard maintenance man. That seems weird. I'm going to go investigate. And sure enough, he crawls up inside one of these robots standing guard over the vault where the gem was stolen. And there's a camera inside looking right at the key code so that the bad guy can go in there and key in the code and steal the jewels. And so so Janice and Dane decide to go and confront Al, the robot repairman.
Right.
His wife, Peggy, is always demanding stuff.
God, my life sucks.
Just all day working at the Al's robot service. They find out that there's a big conspiracy that he wants to.
Came into the robot store today, Stephen.
They find out that there's this conspiracy that he's going to put these robots in a bunch of people's houses. And just as she's about to be shot by Al, the bad guy, Chameleon Boy goes from being Dane to some octoid man from the planet Luvan. And knocks Al out, and then suddenly when he transforms back to Chameleon Boy, she's like, oh, you saved my life. Oh, that means you were doing a masquerade. Oh, I guess I can still like you, my hero. And he's like, oh, boy, giggity, giggity.
That's just gratitude. I will say that I appreciate the fact that the Octoid looks remarkably like the Impossible Man from Marvel Comics Fantastic Four, which I think is pretty interesting, who would in fact exist at this point. 1963 was his debut. And I do appreciate that they didn't end the story with Chameleon Boy earning her love by being something that he's not. So it's not like she went, oh, I've decided I do love you because you pretended to be something. And then we're going to fly off into the sky in this 1943 Ford Roadster. But I don't know.
I was not a fan of this.
I was not either. I think that the sweetest part of this issue is all of the romance comic moments that Wynn Mortimer gets to do. Because Wynn really excels at that. That's something that you wouldn't get, you know, and love as much from a Kurt Swan or a Jack Abel. And I really do appreciate the points where Dane is like, hi. Let's go swimming.
Oh, man, those gill masks are the creepiest things I've ever seen.
Those are incredibly yonic, and they are just wrong, dude.
I have no mouth, but I must scream.
And I'm like, is that Shadow Lass? No. Is that Lightning Lass? What? It looks like the Legionnaires in the background for a second. I'm like, no, it can't be.
Well,
and then I moved away.
It's a problem with drawing every character to look alike.
Yeah, Wynn does have some, how shall we say this, similar facial structures, you see. Because Karate Kid does look a little bit like Dane. And, of course, Jackie, looks a little bit like Saturn Girl and a little bit like Janice. And we have a lot of, you know, shared facial features. I think this is one of those stories that what it ends up doing, in concert with the Elwinda story and a couple of others that we'll get to soon enough, is it really establishes Silver Age Chameleon Boy as someone who's searching for love and a little bit upset that he doesn't find it.
Yeah.
Which does later kind of shape his character in a lot of different ways.
Well, I'm concerned that in the effort to make these Legion stories more age appropriate, to make them really teenagery, you know, 12, 13, 14, 15 age appropriate, that they're really sending a lot of bad messages at this point. Some of the issues have been really good, but man, for as much as they try to tell an interesting story, they end up stumbling with the unintended message that goes on in the background. And, you know, you and I, white guys, reading this, we probably would never have a problem with this if we were reading it at the time. But I bet if there were other people that were reading this, they would really understand the unintended meaning, or they could really pick up on the unintended meaning of some of the messages that are put forth in these books and really walk away either, you know, super depressed or just upset that what they want to do is being told in the media that they enjoy reading that they don't matter, or that they need to do something about themselves. We had the same problem with Bouncing Boy, right? He became thin. What kind of horrible message does that send to kids? You know, I mentioned the Shadow Last thing earlier in the episode. It's really bad messaging.
I think that part of it is that it is 1969 when these stories are being written. And I feel like we have, especially, you know, in 2019, in that modern thought process, we have a tendency to disassemble something and say, what's the theme? What's the lesson? What do we take away from this? What moral do we learn? And I feel like especially these Silver Age stories aren't written with any thought given to unfortunate implications.
They're probably not. I mean, this is...
Especially in terms of, you know, race relations in 1969 existing.
Right.
You know, admitting to the existence of race relations in 1969 is shocking and progressive.
Right. And I realize you're absolutely right. No thought is put into these because this is kiddie fare. This is stuff for kids that don't need to be thinking about grown-up issues or thinking about grown-up things. This is stuff about love and romance. All those romance comics have been shut down. So we got to give the kids something that's light and fun to read. And who cares if it's got some really awkward moments in it? It's kiddie fare. They're going to just throw this stuff in the trash anyway. No one's ever going to see this stuff ever again.
I don't know about that, but I definitely think that, you know, if you go back and you look at stories of the 1960s where Darren threatens to spank his wife, Samantha, it's a different kind of context for things. That was something that they found funny. They thought it was, you know, a silly ha-ha thing.
Oh, sure.
And looking at it today, we're like, wow, domestic abuse is your punchline. Okay.
Well, even if you go back and look at the meme Papa Spank, right, with Batman bending the woman over his knee and giving her a spanking. I mean, it's like, what the what? What were you people thinking of? And they really weren't. But again, I realize that, and I know exactly where you're coming from when you say, well, it was a different time. But at the same time, I think we still need to call this stuff out today.
Oh, absolutely.
And say this really wasn't appropriate. And if people are looking to these kinds of stories and saying, oh, that's the kind of stuff we need to be writing today, then no, I don't think you do need to be writing that kind of stuff today. Or you need to be taking more care in the quote unquote kiddie stuff that you're writing today.
Yes.
I like this thing when the science police show up at the compound and lock it down. Basically, it's like, if any of these kids try to leave this drug-crazed sex party, kill them.
Give them credit. They're like, oh, an expensive thing has been stolen. We are authoritarians in the 31st century. We will find them.
Yeah, it's pretty funny.
If you enjoy the show, we would appreciate your support. You can find out more and become a Legion Clubhouse member at patreon.com/majorspoilers.
So I mentioned in Action Comics 383 that Reap looks a lot like Greg Brady. And yes. I know at this time they're not doing stunt casting. But at any time and I know there have been some instances, but have there ever been any like Scooby-Doo mystery movie things where stunt casting has come in where, you know, suddenly the gang is standing around in Legion headquarters or Justice League or whatever, and you suddenly hear this voice off panel go, maybe I can help. And everyone turns around. And it's like Bill Cosby or, you know, Don Knotts. I mean, have there ever been any intentional stunt castings? I know there was the famous Kill the Beatles wasn't it Kill the Beatles thing? With Batman,
it was
or the
a Beatles
monkeys.
Pastiche, actually.
Okay, all right.
But yes, they're actually the first one that pops up for me is when you talk about that is Uri Geller, the parapsychologist? Teamed up with Daredevil.
Yeah. Oh, okay, all right.
In the 70s to defeat a telepathic supervillain.
And I know David Letterman has appeared. We've had past presidents appear as themselves.
Yeah, there's
in
a
comics.
Really good Superman issue that I did as a retro review several years ago, where Superman teams up with Orson Welles.
Oh, okay.
And Orson Welles, of course, is coming off of his notoriety for War of the Worlds. Superman and Orson have to team up to stop a real alien invasion that they then play off as another fake alien invasion by Orson Welles.
Okay.
Welles actually ends up on Mars trying to warn people on Earth, oh my God, the Martians are attacking. And they're like, we're not going to fall for the banana in the tailpipe.
You're not going to fall for the banana in the tailpipe? Kids, go talk to your parents about that one.
And I do love, there's a Howard the Duck issue where Howard is in a mental health facility.
Right.
He's having some serious issues and he hallucinates Kiss. And Kiss shows up and helps him to break out of his funk. And Kiss is like, hey, Howard, when reality gives you trouble, you just kiss it right on the mouth. Detroit Rock City! And then they just disappear. And it's completely ridiculous, you know, crazy stuff. Then there's the one, you got to think about the one that didn't happen. Do you remember when the Ecstatics almost had Lady Di as a member?
Oh, yeah, that was something that was this like, we're going to bring her back from the dead. And everyone's like, no, you're not. And then Marvel was like, oh, yeah, okay, we won't do that.
Marvel was like, we're going to do it. And finally, their executive editor, and I think it was Avi Arad, was like, I am actually a friend of the royal family. And they have literally petitioned me to ask us not to do this. We can't do this. And so they literally went in like a week before the issue went to air and scribbled out all of the blonde hair and turned her into a pop star named Henrietta.
Hmm.
And the issue came out. And then, of course, the rest of the arc didn't really make any sense because it was all about, you know, it was initially written with the expectation that it was Diana Spencer. So sequences involving, you know, landmines and strange war crimes don't make any sense if it's not Diana Spencer. And then, of course, she ends up leading the team and then she ends up dying. So
I was just curious. Sometimes you see them in there, but I didn't know if they ever just pulled the, you know, the Scooby-Doo. Hey, it's Don Knotts this issue. And Don Knotts is going to go help Batman solve a crime. And then afterwards, see ya, Don Knotts. It's been nice
knowing
you.
Superman and Muhammad Ali fought off an alien invasion together.
I don't really see that one as a stunt casting. I see the one that the Superman JFK is stunt casting. I think the Captain America, President Nixon thing is a bit of a stunt casting.
He also met Carter and Reagan.
Right. So I see those as stunt castings. Well, he also fought Nixon, right? And it turned out to be Red Skull both times.
Nixon turned out to be the leader of the secret empire and killed himself.
Yeah.
Reagan was infected with a serpent virus and turned into a powerful snake man and fought him in the actual White House.
Oh, man, if you were trying to perpetuate the myth that lizard people were controlling the government, that would have been the one to do it.
What?
You've never heard the rumor that lizard men from the center of the earth are controlling all the governments of the world?
Oh, God.
Seriously, man, go look that one up. It is
so
hysterical.
Glad I never listened to Coast AM. Where does
I don't think he talks about that one. I don't think he ever got into lizard men. I think he kind of poo-pooed that. Although he did have Neil Adams on his show. This was after Art had gone. But they did have Neil Adams on George Norrie.
Earth theory?
To talk about the expanding Earth and the hollow Earth theories. Yes. Yeah.
Action Comics number 384, Lament for a Legionnaire. Published January 1979. Written by Jim Shooter with art by Kurt Swan and Jack Abel. Synopsis: Dream Girl sees a fatal future for one of the Legionnaires. Can anything save Mon-El?
Action Comics 384.
It's the Eltro issue, you guys.
The Eltro issue?
Eltro Gand.
Tell us about Eltro Gand.
All right. So somewhere down the line, this will all make sense. But in this issue, Dream Girl, who has normally got the ability to see into the future and have these weird kind of premonitions that may or may not be true, suddenly is treated as a Cassandra. And it is infallible version of a real future that cannot be changed. And someone is going to die, you guys. And she sees Mon-El killed. So Mon-El is like, oh, what am I going to do? I'm going to deal with my own mortality. And then he flies off into space and he comes back. But he's weird, see? And then he like actually does die. And he's like, oh, wait, no, I'm not really dead. I'm actually Lars' great-great-grandson, Eltro. And Eltro Gand has taken over the role of Mon-El and hidden Mon-El on a planet. Uh-oh, he forgot to give him his serum and Mon-El really dies.
Forgot to give him his diabetes medicine.
That's not funny, dude.
I'm not saying it's funny. I'm saying that same thing happens, right? And Mon-El has to take a pill to keep the lead poisoning at bay. And by the way, look at that panel where he's glubbing his secret formula. And holy crap, I think there's a little something else mixed in with that secret formula. But just like a diabetic, if they don't take their insulin shots, it can be fatal for them. And in this case, that's what happened when Eltrogand shows up and accidentally kills his great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather.
Yep.
And then they have to do some crazy lightning lad reversal of body spirits.
Yes.
Which also doesn't make a lot of sense and is also quite weird in this specific case, weirder than the lightning lad story. And then suddenly Mon-El is back to normal and Princess Dream Girl's visions come true, question mark?
Well, she saw someone in Mon-El's costume die. Someone in Mon-El's costume did die. And then Eltro transferred his life essence into Mon-El using technology actually,
so
kind
isn't
of inspired
that just,
by the stuff that brought back
isn't
lightning
that
lad.
Just still the way that they talk about I'm transferring my life essences into this other body. Isn't that just moving Eltrogand into Mon-El's body?
In this case, I'm gonna give you a little bit of a spoiler.
Okay.
Yeah.
So is it revealed
it
years later?
A huge plot point about 15 years down the line.
Okay.
Because there's a lot of stuff that happens in between, but Mon-El starts to become very unstable in the 70s and starts having a lot of issues dealing with his 1,000 years of phantom zonery and just being, very not like the Mon-El we've seen. And eventually it is revealed that much as, spoilers, Lightning Lad was not resurrected so much as Prodi was transitioned into his body.
Yeah.
Eltro's mind overwrote Mon's.
Oh, boy.
And Mon-El does not come back until Volume 4 of the Legion in 1989 as Mon-El himself. But we don't know that here in 1969. We just know that.
I mean, if I can pick up on this stuff decades before it happens, that is some weird mumbo jumbo science stuff that's going on in this issue.
Yeah. Well, and this issue is actually more successful than any of the recent issues for a couple of reasons.
I agree with you. We've got Kurt Swan art in here.
Yep.
Swan, I think that's one of the pluses.
And it's interesting because Jack Abel, who's doing the inks, manages to keep Swanny, for lack of a better word, but also tries to make it kind of match up with what he's been doing with Win Mortimer.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So it still feels like it's of a piece. And I think the other thing that makes this really strong is we get this really great montage of Mon-El dealing with his oncoming mortality, but he's also giving us the capsule, the elevator pitch of everything that's happened to him since 1959.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, oh yes, it's this costume that I wore when I first flew to Daxum, and then I met Superboy, and then I got lead poisoning, and then I spent 1,000 years in the Phantom Zone, and now I'm a Legionnaire, and this is my cool suit, and this is my Nehru jacket, and my name is Mon-El. Write that down, kids,
so,
because you'll need it
later. Catching the reader up on all of the back history of Mon-El, that must mean that Mon-El is going to take center stage for at least the next 5 or 6 issues.
You'd think that.
Bad editing. Just bad editing.
I think it's less bad editing than it is just catch-as-catch-can writing. We're going to write a story. We're going to get it out. And our primary thing is it drawn on time?
Yeah. Speaking of drawings, I want to point out Dream Girl's dream, where you see Superboy carrying Mon-El. Oh my, I know that is, religious iconography, but that is the future cover of Crisis on Infinite Earths, but swap out Mon-El for Supergirl. Boom, right there.
Yeah. It's a modification of Michelangelo's La Pietà.
Yeah. Yep.
You also can see Cyclops holding Dark Phoenix like that and Death holding Captain Marvel. There's like a whole huge run of them with the dead guy slumped over in the arms of the hero. But
since we're talking about some weird science mumbo jumbo, let me bring up the other weird science mumbo jumbo
that
we haven't talked about before. But since Dream Girl is the catalyst for the death of Mon-El, the death and resurrection of Mon-El, I don't know how many people know about Edgar Casey, a.k.a. the Sleeping Prophet. Are you familiar with Edgar Casey? So here's this dude that in the 1920s or something like this, I don't remember if he was in an accident or what happened, but he started having these dreams and would, you know, have dreams about, oh, this boy down the road needs some medical attention and here's what he needs to do to fix this. And sure enough, once or twice, apparently it worked. But then people started thinking about, oh my gosh, maybe this guy can foretell the future.
Right.
And so he would put himself in either a hypnotic state or trance, he would go in, he would go to sleep and he would start talking in his sleep. And there would be somebody who would transcribe everything that Casey would say. And then these would either be predictions or how to solve a particular chronic illness or whatever it is. Casey would always come out of these things and say he would never remember what anything happened in these dreams, but he would have these writings down. And I don't think he was one of the, I'm pretty sure he was not an automatic writing person. I think somebody was literally in the room with him transcribing stuff. But he became super famous in the 1920s, well, even before the 1920s, but the early 1900s through the 1930s, as mysticism in the United States had a super big resurgence. There was a big mysticism stuff that was going on in the late 1800s during the Queen Victoria era, the Victorian era. But then that transitioned. It went silent for a while. I think right around the time World War One started, it kind of went away. But then right after World War One, mysticism came back in with a force. And Casey was one of those people who, I don't know if he was faking it or if he truly believed in his own stuff, but he was making some money as the sleeping prophet. And it's an interesting, fascinating story to read if you ever want to figure out whether people believed in psychic abilities or, you know, other beings from higher planes coming and talking to you about stuff. Some of Casey's biggest predictions had to do with Atlantis, and that's where he got a lot of his big stuff going on. But I'm just wondering, I was looking, there was, I thought, a period. There was a book that was written in, I can't remember what year the book was written, but it, there were a couple of books written about Casey and some of his writings that came out, I want to say in like the 1950s, I want to say, about, and I think it was this Wesley Harrington Ketchum, I think, wrote this book about him. And I think it had a resurgence in the late 1960s, early 1970s. Yeah, the name of the book is The Outer Limits of Edgar Casey's Powers. Came out in 1971. So this would have been a little bit ahead of Dream Girl or anything like that. But I wonder if Dream Girl's creators had ever known anything about Edgar Casey and his powers. I mean, he was in talks with, he was in communication with Woodrow Wilson and Thomas Edison and Irving Berlin and George Gershwin and you name it. And just the average Joe. So people would know the name Edgar Casey.
Right.
But I wonder if Casey's dreamlike predictions ever played a part in the creation of Dream Girl.
Well, I know there was a book about him that would have come out in 64.
What was that?
The Discovery of Edgar Casey.
Oh, okay. So
by Ketchum.
Okay. So it was the same author. So
yeah.
I'm wondering if in this resurgence, but again, this would have nothing to do with Dream Girl, because when was Dream Girl introduced?
1963, I think.
So this would have been a year before that book came out, but I'm still wondering if there were people who were aware of Edgar Casey and just was like, oh yeah, what if there was a Legion member who had the powers of dream predictions?
The Dream Police.
Maybe.
It's interesting. And you know, the... Actually, Adventure 317 would have been February of 64.
So maybe right around the same time. I mean,
it's
but again,
possible.
Casey was popular all the way up through the late 1940s. I want to say he died in like 68. Oh, no, that's Ketchum that died in like 68.
Yeah.
But yeah, people would have known this name in the time period. And certainly in the 1970s, again, with the dawning of the Age of Aquarius, a lot of the new mysticism started to come back into play, and Casey was again right there in the forefront. Casey died in 1945.
Casey, and I'm Director Casey.
Yeah. So what do you think about that?
I think it's interesting. I think it's definitely something that you have to take into account, whether it's archetypical stuff that, you know, someone falls asleep and dreams the future, or if that is a direct influence, either way, I think that it's fascinating. And I think that it does show in this issue kind of perhaps a change in the thought process on those sort of mystical entities and thought processes, because previously Dream Girl was like, oh, well, I saw the future. And everybody's like, ah, pff, God, you can't see the future. You're stupid. And that she's been disproven. Mm-hmm. This issue treats her dreams as an unbreakable, irrevocable prophecy. Mon-El will die.
Right.
Based on the fact that they saw it in a dream.
Which, this is not the first time, nor is it probably going to be the last time, where we encounter a story of, you're about to die, you know you're going to die, how are you going to spend your final moments? This is like the third time we've done this particular story, in the Legion of Superheroes, whether it is an entire team of Legion members, whether it's Superman, or whether it's Mon-El. The third time, I think, that we've come across this story of, you're going to die, how do you spend your last days?
Well, it's a heady question. How do you face your own mortality? What do you do if you know you're going to die and there's nothing you can do to stop it? And
I've said before, I go to a movie, spend some time with the family, take a few naps.
I would never take a nap if I knew I had limited time. But Mon-El's take on it is, I'm going to do everything that I normally do. I'm going to get up, get out of bed, drag a comb across my head.
Hopefully
gonna have some food and put on a cape, and then I'm gonna fly into town and I'll go into a dream.
Make sure that I'm not around any lead pencils.
Right. Well, that's not lead. That's graphite, dude.
Oh, come
that's
on. Back in the 1960s, it was all lead. You could get
that's
lead poisoning from
mistake.
Being stabbed by a pencil man. I could take out Mon-El with one number two pencil in 1969.
I'm not speaking to you anymore.
Hooray! We have come to the end of another episode of the Legion of Superheroes. Matthew, what did we learn this week?
We learned that if you think you're going to die, you need to seal off your secret room and bust through the floor and knock over your friend Element Lad and probably give him a concussion.
If your doctor tells you that you need to take a pill every single day, take the pill every single day. Also, life alert bracelets.
And even in the 30th century, identical cousins are still a thing.
That wraps it up for this installment of the Legion Clubhouse. Thank you so much for downloading and checking us out. And thank you to everyone who has become a patron. It allows this show to continue to grow. And if you're listening to this show and go, oh, man, I'm learning so much. I have a lot to discuss with you guys about stuff. I want to see this show going. Then consider becoming a patron over at patreon.com/majorspoilers. We will be back next time to talk more. Next time, I think we're doing Action Comics 385, 386. But until then, I'm Dream a Little Dream, boy.
And I'm Eltro Schleicher.
The Legion Clubhouse is a production of Major Spoilers Entertainment, LLC, and is produced by Steven Schleicher. Your hosts were Matthew Peterson and Steven Schleicher. You can follow Matthew at Mighty King Cobra and Steven at Major Spoilers. You can follow this podcast on Twitter at Legion Clubhouse. If you have questions or comments, send them to podcast@majorspoilers.com. I'm Jason Inman. Until next time, eat it, Grandpa.
This podcast is copyright 2019 by Major Spoilers Entertainment, LLC.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.